no intelligence was ever provided from any detainee the CIA held. That is false, and the study makes no such claim. What is true is that actionable intelligence that was, quote, otherwise unavailable, was not obtained using these coercive interrogations, where the use of interrogation techniques that do not involve physical force were effective. Specifically, the report provides examples where interrogators had sufficient information to confront detainees with facts, know when they were lying, and when they apply and where they applied rapport building techniques that were developed and honed by the United States military, the FBI, and more recently, the interagency high-value detainee interrogation group called the HEG, that these techniques produced good intelligence. Let me make a couple of additional comments on the claimed effectiveness of CIA interrogations. At no time did the CIA's coercive interrogation techniques lead to the collection of intelligence on an imminent threat that many believe was the justification for the use of these techniques. The committee never found an example of this hypothetical ticking time bomb scenario. The use of coercive technique methods regularly resulted in fabricated information. Sometime the CIA actually knew detainees were lying. Other times, the CIA acted on false information, diverting resources and leading officers or contractors to falsely believe they were acquiring unique or actionable intelligence, and that its interrogations were working when they were not. Internally, CIA officers often called into question the effectiveness of the CIA's interrogation techniques, noting how the techniques failed to elicit detainee cooperation or produce accurate information. The report includes numerous examples of CIA officers questioning the agency's claims. But these contradictions were marginalized and not presented externally. The second set of findings and conclusions is that the CIA provided extensive inaccurate information about the program and its effectiveness to the White House, the Department of Justice, Congress, the CIA Inspector General, the media, and the American public. This conclusion is somewhat personal for me. I remember clearly when Director Hayden briefed the Intelligence Committee for the first time on the so-called EITs at that September 2006 committee meeting. He referred specifically to a, quote, tummy slap, end quote, among other techniques, and presented the entire set of techniques as minimally harmful and implied in a highly clinical and professional manner. They were not. The committee's report demonstrates that these techniques were physically very harmful and that the constraints that existed on paper in Washington did not match the way techniques were used at CIA sites around the world. A particular note was the treatment of Abu Zubaydah over a span of 17 days in August of 2002. This involved nonstop interrogation and abuse, 24/7, from August 4th to August 21st, and included multiple forms of deprivation and physical assault. The description of this period, first written up by our staff in early 2009 while Senator Rockefeller was chairman, is what prompted this full review. But the inaccurate and incomplete descriptions go far beyond that. The CIA provided inaccurate memoranda and explanations to the Department of Justice while its legal counsel was considering the legality of the coercive techniques. In those communications to the Department of Justice, the CIA claimed the following. The coercive techniques would not be used with excessive repetition. Detainees would always have an opportunity to provide information prior to the use of the techniques. The techniques were to be used in progression, starting with the least aggressive and proceeding only if needed. Medical personnel would make sure that interrogations wouldn't cause serious harm, and they could intervene at any time to stop interrogations. Interrogators were carefully vetted and highly trained. And each technique was to be used in a specific way without deviation and only with specific approval for the interrogator and detainee involved. None of these assurances, which the Department of Justice relied on to form its legal opinions, were consistently or even routinely carried out. In many cases, important information was withheld from policymakers. For example, Foreign Intelligence Committee Chairman Bob Graham asked a number of questions after he was first briefed in September of 2002, but the CIA refused to answer him, effectively stonewalling him until he left the committee at the end of the year. In another example, the CIA, in coordination with White House officials and staff, initially withheld information of the CIA's interrogation techniques from Secretary of State Colin Powell and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. There are CIA records stating that Colin Powell wasn't told about the program at first because there were concerns that, and I quote, Powell would blow his stack if he were briefed. Source, email from John Rizzo, dated July 31, 2003. CIA records clearly indicate, and definitively, that after he was briefed on the CIA's first detainee, Abu Zubaydah, the CIA didn't tell President Bush about the full nature of the EITs until April 2006. That's what the records indicate. The CIA similarly withheld information or provided false information to the CIA Inspector General during his conduct of a special review by the IG in 2004. Incomplete and inaccurate information from the CIA was used in documents provided to the Department of Justice and as a basis for President Bush's speech on September 6, 2006, in which he publicly acknowledged the CIA program for the first time. In all of these cases, other CIA officers acknowledged internally that information the CIA had provided was wrong. The CIA also misled other CIA White House officials. When Vice President Cheney's counsel, David Addington, asked CIA Counsel General Scott Mueller in 2003 about the CIA's videotaping the waterboarding of detainees, Mueller deliberately told him that videotapes, quote, were not being made, end quote, but did not disclose that videotapes of previous waterboarding.
All right, y'all, welcome to the show. It is the Scott Horton Show, and yes, I'm playing Dianne Feinstein audio live right now from the well of the U.S. Imperial Senate. She is reading her speech on the release of the redacted summary of the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on the George W. Bush torture regime.
In conclusion, notes the various ways in which CIA management of the detention and interrogation program from its inception to its formal termination in January of 2009 was inadequate and deeply flawed. There is no doubt that the detention interrogation program was by any measure a major CIA undertaking. It raised significant legal and policy issues and involved significant resources and funding. It was not, however, managed as a significant CIA program. Instead, it had limited oversight and lacked formal direction and management. For example, in the 6 months between being granted detention authority and taking custody of its first detainee, Abu Zubaydah, the CIA had not identified and prepared a suitable detention site. It had not researched effective interrogation techniques or developed a legal basis for the use of interrogation techniques outside of the rapport-building techniques that were official CIA policy until that time. In fact, there is no indication the CIA reviewed its own history. That's just what Helgerson was saying in 05, with coercive interrogation tactics. As the executive summary notes, the CIA had engaged in rough interrogation in the past. In fact, the CIA had previously sent a letter to the Intelligence Committee in 1989, and here is the quote, that inhumane physical or psychological techniques are counterproductive because they do not produce intelligence and will probably result in false answers, end quote. That was a letter from John Helgerson, CIA Director of Congressional Affairs, dated January 8, 1989. However, in late 2001 and 2, rather than research interrogation practices and coordinate with other parts of the government with extensive expertise in detention and interrogation of terrorist attacks, the CIA engaged two contract psychologists who had never conducted interrogations themselves or ever operated detention facilities. As the CIA captured or received custody of detainees through 2002, it maintained separate lines of management at headquarters for different detention facilities. No individual or office was in charge of the detention and interrogation program until January of 2003, by which point more than one-third of CIA detainees identified in our review had been detained and interrogated. One clear example of flawed CIA management was the poorly managed detention facility referred to in our report by the code name Cobalt to hide the actual name of the facility. It began operations in September of 2002. The facility knew few formal records of the detainees, the facility kept few formal records of the detainees housed there, and untrained CIA officers conducted frequent, unauthorized, and unsupervised interrogations using techniques that were not and never became part of the CIA's formal enhanced interrogation program. The CIA placed a junior officer with no relevant experience in charge of the site. In November 2002, an otherwise healthy detainee who was being held mostly nude and chained to a concrete floor died at the facility from what is believed to have been hypothermia. In interviews conducted in 2003, by the CIA officer of the Inspector General, CIA's leadership acknowledged that they had little or no awareness of operations at this specific CIA detention site. And some CIA officials, senior officials, believed erroneously that enhanced interrogation techniques were not used there. The CIA in its June 2013 response to the committee's report agreed that there were management failures in the program, but asserted that they were corrected by early 2003. While the study found that management failures improved somewhat, we found they persisted till the end of the program. Among the numerous management shortcomings identified in the report are the following. The CIA used poorly trained and non-vetted personnel. Individuals were deployed, in particular interrogators, without relevant training or experience. Due to the CIA's redactions to the report, there are limits to what I can say in this regard, but it's a clear fact that the CIA deployed officers who had histories of personal, ethical, and professional problems of a serious nature. These included histories of violence and abusive treatment of others, and should have called into question their employment with the United States government, let alone their suitability to participate in a sensitive CIA covert action program. The two contractors that CIA allowed to develop, operate, and assess its interrogation operations conducted numerous inherently governmental functions that never should have been outsourced to contractors. These contractors are referred in the report in special pseudonyms, Swigert and Dunbar. They developed the list of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques that the CIA employed. They personally conducted interrogations of some of the CIA's most significant detainees using the techniques, including the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and al-Nashiri. The contractors provided the official evaluations of whether detainees' psychological states allowed for the continued use of the enhanced techniques. Even for some detainees, they themselves were interrogating or had interrogated. Evaluating the psychological state of the very detainees they were interrogating is a clear conflict of interest and a violation of professional guidelines. The CIA relied on these two contractors to evaluate the interrogation program they had devised and in which they had obvious financial interests. Again, a clear conflict of interest and an avoidance of responsibility by the CIA. In 2005, the two contractors formed a company specifically for the purpose of expanding their work with the CIA. From 05 to 08, the CIA outsourced almost all aspects of its detention and interrogation program to this country as part of a contract valued at more than $180 million. Ultimately, not all contract options were exercised. However, the CIA has paid these two contractors and their company more than $80 million. Of the 119 individuals found to have been detained by the CIA during the life of the program, the committee found that at least 26 were wrongfully held. These are cases where the CIA itself determined that it had not met the standard for detention set out in the 2001 Memorandum of Notification, which governs a covert action. Detainees often remained in custody for months after the CIA determined they should have been released. CIA records provide insufficient information to justify the detention of many other detainees. Due to poor record keeping, a full accounting of how many specific detainees were held and how they were specifically treated while in custody may never be known. Similarly, in specific instances, we found that enhanced interrogation techniques were used without authorization, in a manner far different and more brutal than had been authorized by the Office of Legal Counsel, and conducted by personnel not approved to use them on detainees. Questions about how and when to apply interrogation techniques were ad hoc and not proposed, evaluated, and approved in the manner described by the CIA in written descriptions and testimony about the program. Detainees were often subject to harsh and brutal interrogation and treatment because CIA analysts believe, often in error, that they knew more information than what they had provided. Sometimes CIA managers and interrogators in the field were uncomfortable with what they were being asked to do and recommended ending the abuse of a detainee. Repeatedly, in such cases, they were overruled by people at CIA headquarters who thought they knew better, such as by analysts with no line authority. This shows again how a relatively small number of CIA personnel, perhaps 40 to 50, were making decisions on detention and interrogation, despite the better judgments of other CIA officers. The fourth and final set of findings and conclusions concern how the interrogations of CIA detainees were absolutely brutal, far worse than the CIA represented them to policymakers and others. Beginning with the first detainee, Abu Zubaydah, and continuing with numerous others, the CIA applied its so-called enhanced interrogation techniques in combination and in near-stop fashion for days and even weeks at a time on one detainee. In contrast to CIA representations, detainees were subjected to the most aggressive techniques immediately, stripped naked, diapered, physically struck, and put in various painful stress positions for long periods of time. They were deprived of sleep for days, in one case up to 180 hours, that's 7.5 days over a week with no sleep, usually standing or in stress positions, at times with their hands tied together over their heads, chained to the ceiling. In the Cobalt facility I previously mentioned, interrogators and guards used what they called rough takedowns, in which a detainee was grabbed from his cell, clothes cut off, hooded, and dragged up and down a dirt hallway while being slapped and punched. The CIA led several detainees to believe they would never be allowed to leave CIA custody alive, suggesting to Abu Zubaydah that he would only leave in a coffin-shaped box. That's a CIA cable from August 12, 2002. According to another CIA cable, CIA officers also planned to cremate Zubaydah should he not survive his interrogation. Source, CIA cable, July 15, 2002. After the news and photographs emerged from the United States military detention of Iraqis at Abu Ghraib, the Intelligence Committee held a hearing on the matter on May 12, 2004. Without disclosing any details of its own interrogation program, CIA Director John McLaughlin testified that CIA interrogations were nothing like what was depicted at Abu Ghraib, the United States prison in Iraq where detainees were abused by American personnel. This, of course, was false. CIA detainees at one facility, described as a dungeon, were kept in complete darkness, constantly shackled in isolated cells with loud noise or music and only a bucket to use for human waste. The U.S. Bureau of Prisons personnel went to that location in November 2002, and according to a contemporaneous internal CIA email, told CIA officers they had, quote, never been in a facility where individuals are so sensory deprived, end quote. Again, source, CIA email, sender and recipient redacted, December 5, 2002. Throughout the program, multiple CIA detainees subject to interrogation exhibited psychological and behavioral issues, including hallucinations, paranoia, insomnia, and attempts at self-harm and self-mutilation. Multiple CIA psychologists identified the lack of human contact experienced by detainees as a cause of psychiatric problems. The executive summary includes far more detail than I'm going to provide here about things that were in these interrogation sessions. And the summary itself includes only a subset of the treatment of the 119 CIA detainees. There is far more detail, all documented, in the full 6,700-page study. This summarizes briefly the committee's findings and conclusions. Before I wrap up, I'd like to thank the people who made this undertaking possible. First, I thank Senator Jay Rockefeller. He started this project by directing his staff to review the operational cables that describe the first recorded interrogations after we learned that the videotapes of those sessions had been destroyed. And that report was what led to this multi-year investigation. And without it, we wouldn't have really had any sense of what had happened. I thank other members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, one of whom is on the floor today from the great state of New Mexico. Others have been on the weekends for years in some of the most difficult circumstances. It's no secret to anyone that the CIA does not want this report coming out. And I believe the nation owes them a debt of gratitude. They are Dan Jones, who has led this review since 2007, and more than anyone else, today is a result of his effort. Evan Gottesman and Chad Turner, two other members of the study staff, each wrote thousands of pages of the full report and have dedicated themselves and much of their lives to this project. Alyssa Starzak, who began this review as co-head and contributed extensively unto her departure from the committee in 2011. Other key contributors to the drafting, editing, and review of the report were Jennifer Barrett, Nick Bassiano, Mike Buchwald, Jim Catella, Eric Chapman, John Dickus.
All right, I don't care about this. Listen, thank you, everybody, for being patient. I hate Dianne Feinstein, too, okay? She's a horrible person every way. She's actually not even a human being. She literally is the fictitious sock puppet of her military-industrial complex husband who makes money raping your Treasury Department all day, every day. And so she is his front man in the Imperial Senate, so as to better conspire against your wallet. So, I'm out of it, and it's important what she's saying. So, listen, today on the show, it's going to be mostly the torture show. Other Scott Horton is going to be on here. He's a real legal expert. And Phil Giraldi is going to be on the show. And I know what you're thinking. I kind of think it too. Jeez, man, the day a torture report comes out about the CIA, you're going to have a former CIA officer on your show? But just wait till you hear what he has to say. It's not going to be a bunch of, oh, it's just fine. And in fact, I deliberately call them as an antidote to what you're going to be hearing on TV all day, you know, well, on Fox anyway, about how, yeah, but look, a former CIA officer says we just got to trust him, that he knows that, never mind what Dianne Feinstein says, that torture's great. And that's what conservatives believe in. After all, that's what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. He said, seek out your enemies and crush them, murder them, torture them, threaten to murder their children, their mothers. And so that's what conservatives in Poland. First, it belonged to Adolf Hitler. Then it belonged to Joseph Stalin and the people that came after him. And then there's a little interregnum there. And then the very same base was used by the CIA to torture people in Poland. And it was Larissa who broke that story. It was Dana Priest in the Washington Post, of course, who always gets the credit for it. But she was the one who refused to publish the names of even the countries where the CIA torture was taking place. It was Human Rights Watch that revealed Morocco. And I forget who revealed Thailand, maybe Jane Mayer, something like that. But it was Larissa that showed that it was a former Nazi, then communist, then American base where they tortured people in Poland. That's kind of important. Introducing Nebojsa Malik. He writes for antiwar.com, Moments of Transition. Boy, say that again. is the name of his column there. And again, greyfalcon.blogspot.com is the name of his great blog. And so the subject this morning is the Ukrainian Nazis, of just who are these Ukrainian Nazis, how much power do they really have, and just how closely they're in bed with the United States of America. Welcome back to the show, Nebojsa.
Thanks, Scott. Good to be back.
I really appreciate it. And sorry for the extra long introduction there, but please, if you could, who are these guys? How much power do they really have? Because I heard that they hardly have any power at all. And what's their relationship with the U.S. at this point?
Well, the official line is that there are no Nazis in Kiev. This is a, you know, peaceful, wonderful democracy, and all they want is democracy and freedom and all this other jazz that, and you can observe from verifiable facts on the ground that this is absolutely not the case. But just about every party that's in the current parliament in Kiev has some ties to the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, led in the 1930s and 1940s by Stepan Bandera, who was an eager collaborator with Hitler. And Bandera was assassinated by the Soviets in 1959, but his successor, Stetsko, actually made it over to the U.S. as part of a massive program of evacuating Nazis and Nazi collaborators from Europe in the initial stages of the Cold War. And Ukrainian Nazis, as well as Nazis from other European countries, formed these captive nations committees and kept up the Cold War propaganda in the U.S. I guess, you know, they figured they could use the U.S. for their own ends. The U.S. thought they could use them, and who's using whom exactly doesn't really matter. In the end, it's all the taxpayer money that gets spent and American lives that get lost, as well as the lives and futures of countless people abroad. You've basically had several of these organizations on the deserving margins of society in Ukraine prior to the February coup. A lot of these people came back to Ukraine in the 1990s after the Declaration of Independence, after the demise of the Soviet Union, and tried to impose their brand of Ukrainian nationalism and Ukrainian national identity, which is violently anti-Semitic, anti-Polish, anti-Lithuanian, anti-Russian, anti-everything. They really haven't had much luck until 2004, when the first Orange Revolution hit, and all of a sudden their team, so to speak, was in charge. You had all these, you know, captive nations people from the U.S., who were part of the Yushchenko administration, and they tried pushing this Russophobic, intolerant brand of Ukrainian nationalism, in which, you know, they would change the spellings of words, and you have video clips out there of political activists abusing school children because they quote unquote say their name wrong, and so on and so forth, and. At the same time, they would also have these, you know, commemoration societies. And I mean, okay, you've got your Civil War reenactors in this country that dress up in the blues and the grays and try to do, you know, reenact Civil War battles. And that's all mostly good, clean fun. And even when it isn't, it really doesn't have any political overtones. But in Ukraine, you have people dressing up in Waffen-SS uniforms, not to role-play Nazis, but to basically pay homage to their ancestors. There's videos out there shown on Ukrainian state television of these activists staging Nazi funerals for the people that were found in unmarked graves from 1944, when the Red Army was chasing these people out. This is not role-playing. This is not make-believe. These people really do when they say they value their heritage, boy, that's the heritage of, you know, mass murder and genocide. And so these people belong to the party called Svoboda, translated as freedom. You also have another party called Fatherland, not to say that fatherland isn't a legitimate word, but, you know, fatherland and freedom, let's face it here, these are all very ominous sounding names when you translate them properly. And there's also the right sector. Which started out as a band of soccer hooligans, but it's actually pretty much the enforcement arm of the current government, composed of various thugs. One of them has actually been filmed and he filmed it and he posted it, of barging into offices of television and radio stations and slapping around editors for, you know, showing the wrong things or showing Russian programs. He would throw politicians into garbage bins, mind you. Politicians in garbage bins. Some politicians in this country deserve it, but it's still assault and it's still illegal. And this was the routine sort of thing that was going on there. You also had the right sector people behind the horrible massacre in Odessa in May, when essentially protesters who were demonstrating against the coup government and against this illegal overthrow of legal authorities were hounded into a trade union building and set on fire. And then the media said, oh, well, it was, you know, armed Russian activists who attacked the peaceful Ukrainians, and we just had to return fire with machine guns and you know, burn the bastards down. Unrepentant, completely unrepentant. You have these quote-unquote volunteer battalions, some of which are private militias of oligarchs that we've discussed on this show before, and some of which are just outright Nazis. For example, the Azov Battalion – it has as its emblem one of the logos of the SS that was used in Ukraine in the 1940s. They have swastika tattoos. They've got photos of themselves Sieg Heiling. Pictures of Hitler, swastika flags. I mean, this is not one of those. I've seen something that might vaguely resemble swastika in a wrapping paper. These are the people who are openly, overtly, out and out Nazis and proud of it.
Right.
And then you have, you know, Western reporters who go in there and say, okay, so we're here with the Nazis that are defending Ukrainian freedom. And they're trying to spin it as in, well, they might be Nazis, but they're still on our side and therefore they're the good guys.
Right. Yeah, it took the New York Times months to even mention it at all. And then when they did, it was kind of apropos of nothing, sort of tacked on toward the end of an article. Which, by the way, these guys do parade around with Nazi symbols and talk about how much they love Hitler. But anyway... back to the narrative. But, hey, at least they mention it from time to time, the New York Times. All right, we're talking with Neboj Samalich about America's Ukrainian Nazis. More on the other side of this break. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Neboj Samalich about America's Ukrainian Nazis. Yeah, part of the fact of life for a lot of people in the world are from some crappy little country surrounded by great powers. They can't have a revolution without serving the interests of a foreign power. They can't have a political position on anything without serving the interests of a foreign power. Ask the Syrians. They'll explain it to you. And so in Ukraine, there are plenty of people. There are Jews who couldn't possibly be Nazis, who they never liked the kind of pro-Russian Party of Regions guys. They didn't like the previous leader, Yanukovych. They were happy to see him go. But that still makes them the useful idiots of the American Empire and the Social Nationalist Party. Because those are the breaks. That's what happens when you live in a little country that's exploited by foreign powers. And so, you know, the defense that I always hear is, oh, but the Nazis didn't do very well in the election. Well, it depends which election. But also, they sure do seem to be getting sworn into the parliament. So I don't know exactly how your proportional representation system works over there. But there's a Nazi police chief in Kiev. There are Nazi battalions fighting in the east. You've got the co-founder of the Svoboda Party. It has just been sworn in as the deputy chief of something or other, right, Neboj?
Well, yeah, you got to always keep in mind, though, that when we're talking about people holding public office, it doesn't necessarily follow that in countries like Ukraine, which is has officially been turned into a colony at this point, people in office are the people in power. I mean, we just had a couple of foreign citizens who were abruptly given Ukrainian citizenships to be made acceptable, appointed to some key posts there. It's essentially one of those, okay, you know, we're going to put up our people and, you know, if anybody asks if it's legal, we'll say we'll make it legal. Very Imperial Star Wars here, but that's what we're dealing with. Keep in mind also that the current prime minister, who, despite the fact that there's been a couple of elections since February, he's the guy that Victoria Nuland wanted to see in the office, and lo and behold, he's right in office. Mm-hmm. You know, the current president was the one that was favored by the Americans and the EU to be appointed because he was an oligarch who worked for them and he could be trusted. And so, lo and behold, he's in office and he's winning majorities. And it doesn't really matter who votes, but who counts the votes. And again, even if people could dare to vote in the presence of all these Nazi thugs patrolling the polling stations and, you know, torturing and torching people to death who disagree with them, all the opposition parties have been banned. And so they have nobody to vote for. So your choices are Nazis or oligarchs or oligarch Nazis. There's really no other choice beyond that. So, you know, no wonder most Ukrainians actually stayed home and didn't bother to lend the stamp of approval to this regime, but it doesn't matter. You know, it's one of those, if you know, Washington declares elections to be democratic, that's it.
You're saying, though, that if Dmitry Yurash and what's his name, Perubi and Tannenbaum and these other Nazis are given positions in the government, that kind of don't worry about it because it's really the more American loyal technocrat types who are really the ones calling the shots, and these Nazis are just being patted on the head?
No, that's not what I said. That's the perception that the media are nurturing, the mainstream media in the West are saying exactly that. Oh, well, you know.
I was going to say, they made Yurash the head of the National Guard. That doesn't sound like a nothing position to me.
No, that's precisely the point. Those are not nothing positions. They're being spun in the media as nothing positions. Oh, don't you worry about the Nazis. We'll get them into the system. And then you give them positions involving security, public safety, intelligence services, surveillance, policing. Yeah, that's not how you make a country safe, by appointing Nazis into the police. Yeah, that's not how it works. So no, obviously these are not marginal they should be marginal people in any normal society, but they're very much part of the junta government. They're very much part of it. And yet, you know, we're supposed to look at Yatsenyuk, we're supposed to look at Poroshenko, we're supposed to look at all these other people as the public face of Ukraine and continue this fairy tale about the democratically democratizing democracy. And it's BS. It's nonsense. You know, people are dying in the East every day because despite the official ceasefire, the Ukrainian army and these volunteer Nazi battalions are keeping up artillery fire. They're keeping up indiscriminate artillery bombardment, which, you know, in cases of other countries has been deemed to be a war crime. But hey, you know, Ukrainians are just defending themselves. That's the official line in Washington. State Department says so. So we're supposed to believe it. And so these people are committing war crimes on a daily basis.
Yeah. Hey, do you have any idea of the number?
People wonder why the Russians might be upset about it.
Do you know how many refugees have fled into Russia from eastern Ukraine?
At the very least 300,000. Those are official UN figures, although the real number is probably three times that much.
Mm-hmm. And is that why you think they're just doing the kind of random artillery, is just to try to scare all the civilians away, to ethnically cleanse them, as they call it?
Right. Nazis and their supporters are basically on the record. Even Poroshenko said, addressing Ukrainians, believing naively perhaps that, you know, in this day and age, nobody else will hear his remarks, that the goal is to basically eliminate these people, get them out of the territory. And what they want is they want the territory, but not the people in it, because that territory has all sorts of mineral wealth and, you know, shale gas and oil and coal and steel and so on and so forth. So they want the land. And obviously they're obsessed with territory, but they don't want the people. the people inhabiting this territory, they consider Moskals and you know, subhumans and so on. I mean, there's a variety of terms that they've used.
Well, public, and even that was...
Including subhumans.
Yeah, I think subhumans, that was Yatsenyuk. That was the nice guy, the poster boy, that called them subhumans.
Exactly.
The prime minister.
Exactly. And so, again, you have to realize, based on these remarks and based on their behavior, that there are no really nice guys on that particular side.
Yeah.
It's all just different flavors of abysmal.
Yeah, if only they could get the gas princess back in there, then everything would be all right, right?
Oh, but wait. You surely remember Tymoshenko's intercepted phone call when she said she would use nuclear weapons against these, you know, detested Russians and kill them all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was meant as a figure of speech to just, you know, blast them all kind of a thing.
Perhaps in the heat of the moment and everything, but come on.
I mean, her point being that she wanted them outside of her protection. This is a lady who was trying to inherit the state at that moment. I don't know to what degree that was a success again this time around. But she was saying basically, damn them. They are foreigners. They are enemies. They are not part of the Ukrainian people. They're not rebels to be brought back into the Union like Lincoln would have called them, right? They are they're gone. They're an enemy state.
Okay, well, you know, and that's I can see that particular point being made. You know, okay, these people have been written off; they've been declared separatists. You turn your guns on them.
Yeah, she's renouncing her own right to rule them, is what she's doing.
Pretty much, but again, you know, Tymoshenko's a political nobody right now. From being the darling of the EU just a year and a half ago, when you know it was all about securing her release from prison for, you know, financial abuses and embezzlement. Now, you know, she was a darling of the European establishment, not so much of Washington. And look at her now. She's nowhere to be seen because Washington's found new stooges and she's out. She's been used. She's been discarded.
Well, yeah, she can't shoot. They need Nazis to do the killing for them.
But they also need people like her to, you know, get the common people to get on board with the program of, you know, let's nuke these vicious enemies. Not, I mean, Ukrainians of all people ought to know what nuclear fallout can do after, you know, with Chernobyl and everything. They were ground zero for a horrible nuclear disaster. So for them to joke about nuking people is just poor taste, if anything.
Yeah. Well, you know, I would encourage people to look if they're new at this, definitely just put in Google Images, Ukraine and Nazis, and just look. Wow, that's right sector. That's the Azov battalion. These guys are basically kind of the special forces units of the kind of do-nothing Ukrainian military who are actually doing the fighting in the East for America's interests in Ukraine. These guys with the Heil Hitler in the air? You got to be kidding. But no, it's real. I mean, you'll see 100,000 results for who these kooks are. And
it gets worse. I mean, these were the people who were holding torchlight parades. I kid you not. Actual, bona fide torchlight parades in Kiev.
All right, y'all. That's Nebojsa Samalic. Read him at antiwar.com. He's in the right margin right there, Moments of Transition. And read him at greyfalcon.blogspot.com. Thanks again for coming back on the show, Nebojsa.
Thanks for inviting me.
Appreciate it. We'll be right back, y'all, with the other Scott Horton in just a sec.
And an anxiety, an unprecedented crisis. But it is at these times of crisis when we need sound judgment, excellence, and professionalism from the CIA the most. When mistakes are made, they call for self-reflection and scrutiny. For that process to begin, we first have to make sure there is an absolute, accurate public record of what happened. That we are continuing to do. The public release of the executive summary and findings and conclusions is a tremendous and consequential step towards that end. From some, I expect there will be the temptation, the fact, to reject, to cast doubt, to trivialize, to attack, or rationalize parts of the study that are disturbing or are embarrassing. Indeed, the CIA's program dramatic divergence from the standards that we hold ourselves is hard to reconcile. However, we must fight that short-sighted temptation to wish away the gravity of what this study found. How we deal with this opportunity to learn, to improve, will reflect on the maturity of our democracy. As a country, we are strong enough to bear the weight of the mistakes that we have made. And as an institution, so is the Central Intelligence Agency. We must confront this dark period in our recent history with honesty and critical introspection. We must draw lessons. We must apply those lessons as we move forward. Although it may be uncomfortable at times, ultimately we will grow strong and we will ensure that this never happens again. I thank the presiding officer and yield the floor.
Chairman.
The senator from California.
Madam Chairman, I know the time for recess for caucus is approaching, and I know there are other members on the Democratic side that want to speak, and it is now time for a member from the Republican side. I'm going to ask unanimous consent that the recess be delayed for 5 minutes so that the distinguished senator from South Carolina might speak.
Is there objection? Without objection.
Senator Begich, do you need to go ahead? You sure?
Is there objection? Senator from South Carolina.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. I've been a military lawyer for over 30 years. It's been one of the highlights of my life to serve in the Air Force. And during the debate about these techniques, I was very proud of the fact that every military lawyer came out on the side that the techniques in question were not who we are and what we want to be. We are one of the leading voices of the Geneva Convention. We have stood by the Geneva Convention since its inception, and I am convinced that the techniques in question violate the Geneva Convention. And I'm also convinced that they were motivated by fear of another attack. Put yourself in the shoes of the people responsible for defending the country right after 9/11. We'd been hit hard, and everybody thought something else was coming. And as we rounded these guys up, there was a sense of urgency and a commitment to never let it happen again that generated this program. Who knew what, when? I don't know.
Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is where I keep all the interview archives, more than 3,500 of them now, going back to 2003. And by the way, 2003 through 5 work again, too. All right. Next up is the other Scott Horton. And I don't know why I didn't think of this before Scott, but how come we don't do it? We both go by our middle names, and nobody wants to have their first initial because that sounds ridiculous. So, you know, it's not like we're theater actors or something. So, but what we could do is you're Scott Horton Esquire, and I'm Scott Horton JC for junior college. Right?
I'll go however you want. But I'd love to have the transcript say Scott Horton colon, Scott Horton colon. You know?
Yeah, those are fun. Yeah. It's the other Scott Horton. Scott Horton Esquire, the heroic international human rights lawyer, anti-torture crusader, author of Lords of Secrecy, professor of law at Columbia University, contributing writer to Harper's Magazine, and I could go on and on and on. The book Lords of Secrecy, the National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare is on sale now at Amazon.com. For pre-order. It comes out January the 6th. I thank you so much for joining us on the show. So let's talk a little bit about this anti-torture crusading of yours, or I guess I'll just give you space to do some. What do you think is the most important thing for this audience to understand about the new declassified summary of the Senate Intelligence Committee torture report, Scott?
hey, it's a huge day in this matter. And of course, you know, since it went online at 11 o'clock, I've been focused on reading it. But 600 pages, you know, it takes a while to get all the way through it. I'd say, you know, from what I see already and from the executive summary up front, the report saying exactly what a series of leaks said it was going to say early on. That is that for sure, the use of these enhanced interrogation techniques, waterboarding, and other forms of torture did not contribute in any way to catching Osama bin Laden, nor did they contribute to actionable intelligence of any kind whatsoever. And in fact, it's sort of the normal old-fashioned kind of intelligence gathering that worked and proved effective. So no surprises there. But I think it's going at a big level to be very, very important on this question of what's the role of the CIA in our democracy. And, you know, a lot of the pushback that's coming from former CIA directors right now reads like they're trying to preserve the CIA itself from an onslaught. They're afraid that the CIA is going to be stomped out, put out of business, defunded, or something like that. And I would say, reading this, I can understand why they have that concern, because it raises pretty fundamental questions about the way the CIA operates, about its management of funds. So lots of corruption, lots of graft, great amount of criminality, very ineffective oversight, poor management of programs, including legitimate programs. It's pretty sweeping in its criticisms. But I think the big question is, you know, what's the role for an organization like this in a democratic society? And how can an organization like this function without proper oversight, especially coming from Congress? So even though this report looks incredibly detailed and meticulous, and that's just the 600-page summary, it also can be read another way. That is, you know, it is describing in detail a program that existed and was fully developed underneath this committee without the committee taking any notice of it for a period of, 5 or 6 years until they started their inquiry. So that's a failing of oversight by the Senate Select Committee itself.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, just how long was Dianne Feinstein in the dark? Is it right? I mean, I don't know the answer to this question at all. But, certainly she poses as being great on this subject and has clearly done the most work of any senator in trying to get this issue investigated and out before the public. But like you're saying, she was responsible, and certainly the Bush guys must have claimed, I'm assuming, that, oh, come on, we told her what we were doing and she was okay with it, right? Just like Pelosi and the wiretaps, that kind of thing, no? The Gang of Eight and all that.
Yeah, I think there's some really fascinating details in this report about that. So there's no question but that the CIA did some briefing, but it characterized the techniques that were being used in the most positive possible way,
right.
Left out some of them, and misreported exactly how they were being used.
Yeah.
And I would say maybe the most surprising thing I've seen so far doesn't have to do with the briefing of Congress. It has to do with the briefing of George W. Bush. So what we see here is that it wasn't until 2006 that for the first time the CIA saw fit to tell President Bush that they were waterboarding people. They reflect that briefing going on here. And they also reflect that, very much to his credit, President Bush really wasn't pleased when they told him this. It's like, you've been doing this for 4 years and you're telling me now?
Yeah. Well, but come on. I mean, he wanted it that way. Don't tell me. I don't want to know. Do what you want. Gloves off. Grab whom you must. Do what you want. Those are the rules.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have that issue all across the board. That is, you know, people who have responsibility for oversight are supposed to reach in and find the facts. They're not supposed to sit back passively and wait to be briefed on them.
Yeah.
So certainly there's no shortage of criticism to go all around here.
Yeah. Let me get back to what you brought up there. The biggest question about, you know, whether we need a CIA at all, their fear that maybe people are going to start asking that, how much power they have. It seemed like we saw a small taste of this I haven't had a chance to read the report at all yet, but the fight over the report and the CIA spying on the Senate Intelligence Committee staffers repeatedly, and all of that that was going on, and the way the entire attitude that the leadership of the CIA copped about it, John Brennan and his staff against Dianne Feinstein, I'm talking just in the last couple of months here, and they're acting, never mind the executive, they're acting like the CIA itself is more than co-equal to the United States Senate. And, you know, look here, you little debating society, you'll know what we tell you, and you'll go out on C-SPAN and pretend you're the government, and then we'll keep doing what we need to do. That seemed to be the real lesson in that. And I wonder, you're saying you think that people are going to be, it's unavoidable that this kind of conception of what the CIA's power really is going to be brought up for everyone to behold here. There's no way around it.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that this reflects negatively for everybody involved. I mean, you know, the CIA not respecting democracy and democratic institutions, also the Senate not really asserting its rights and prerogatives, and allowing itself to be steamrolled. And I think if we look just at the battle that went on between the CIA and Feinstein's committee, going up to the release of this report over like the last roughly 18 months. And you look at how that played out, you see that the CIA is a much smarter player of this game than the Senate is. I mean, they know how to drag things out for months and months and months and years and years. They make demands of the Senate, which are completely ridiculous. You know, like we're going to have an independent contractor come in and review everything before you get to see it. I mean, that's what happens in civil litigations. That's not what happens in oversight by a congressional committee. They were saying, you're going to use CIA computers. You're going to visit you're going to examine the documents in CIA offices. We're not going to let you do it, even in the secure rooms of the Senate, and on and on and on and on. I mean, all these things were designed to make it more difficult for the Senate and to make it cost much more time. So you spin a process that should have been done in a year to a year and a half into 4 years, effectively, or 5 years. That's what they did. That's their game. They're very, very good at it.
Right. All right. Now, we have a lot more subjects to cover in the next segment. No time to get to them now. But I guess I'll ask you just real quick whether you think we'll ever get to see the full 6,300 pages, even redacted, but at length.
Oh, I think eventually this stuff is going to come out. And I'm just wondering if some senators like Mo Udall or like Senator Udall from Colorado won't just leak it before he leaves. You know, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, we own them, right, is the deal, right? We're free and we allow them to exist to be our security force under the rule of law. That's it. Or the deal is off, right? It says in the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, I think they can redact out names of countries and names of individuals and a few things like that. That's all okay. But, you know, I think we want to know all of this detailed information.
All right, we got to hold it right there. We'll be right back with Scott Horton Esquire, the other Scott Horton, heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer, author of Lords of Secrecy.
To the White House, Congress, and Department of Justice. In each case, the CIA claimed that critical and unique information came from one or more detainees in its custody after they were subjected to the CIA's coercive techniques. And that information led to specific counterterrorism success.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. It's fun to see all the doe-eyed innocents on Twitter saying, oh my God, they threatened to rape somebody's mom. Yeah, Omar Khadr, we already knew about that for a long time. Where have you guys been? He was a 13-year-old boy. Or was he 12? Anyway, I got Scott Horton Esquire on the line. The other Scott Horton, the heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer, author of the brand new book coming out, Lords of Secrecy, master of this subject, the law, the details, the history. He's featured in the movie Taxi to the Dark Side about the murder of young Dilawar, the cab driver, and he's the expert's expert. All right, so I'm not exactly sure where we left off, but I wanted to ask you here, and you can go back to whatever you want. I'll cut my mic off here, Scott, but I want you to please somewhere in there address the question or tell me whether it's your information. Did they address the question of whether torture works just fine if the Republicans have ordered you to torture someone into accusing Saddam Hussein into teaching them how to make chemical weapons and hijack airplanes? In which case, torture is 100% effective every time. You can get anyone to say that. You can get Omar Khadr to say anything if you threaten his mother. Or Sheikh Al-Libi is who I was referring to there, obviously.
But that's definitely right up in the front in the conclusions. That is, you know, one of the reasons torture is not reliable is that someone under torture will try and figure out what's the answer this guy who's questioning me wants to hear. And they're going to say that.
Yeah, but that still sounds like spin to me. It does work, is the point. It works. And Dick Cheney knows it works. And that's why he ordered them to torture people, right? Is because it produces lies.
Exactly. So it produces the answer the questioner wants, you know. And of course, the studies we did of torture from the Korean War, for instance, 1950, and we had, the CIA had a number of very prominent psychologists study the way these tactics were used by the Chinese, by the North Koreans. One of the things we found was that they were using it not with any expectation it was going to render truthful information. They wanted it to produce propaganda. So they were going to use it to prepare people to say, oh yes, we Americans, slit the throats of babies with our bayonets. You know, that's what we do. It's what we're ordered to do, right? So they wanted pure propaganda value from it. And if that's what you want these techniques for, well, they work for that purpose.
Right. But I mean, do they address that honestly though, that it is, that it's the point of it. It's not a bug in the program. It's the point of the program. Boy, we got audio problems today.
Sorry about that.
It's all right. Tell that dump truck to back up again. No.
Exactly.
Correctly. It is a crew.
Okay. Yeah, I think they've got, they have the science and the literature on that,
sure,
lined up. And they address the pushback that's coming, from the Jose Rodriguez's and others. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a question that underlies all of this about the nature of the CIA again. Should the CIA be out there engaged in operations, or should it just be doing analysis? Or should we not, in fact, have a division between the two things? Because I think one thing we see in the background to this whole battle over the torture report is the CIA doesn't want to accept that it made mistakes anywhere. There is this absolute, massive drive to say we did the right thing and it worked. And why that's for institutional reputation and to save careers and to get dollars for the budget and so forth. But if you go back to the launch of the CIA in 1947, Harry Truman said, no, the CIA should be pure analysis. It shouldn't be involved in operations because precisely this sort of problem flows from mixing analysis and operations. People who do operations always want to say that every operation was a great success and got us everything we needed, right? Mm-hmm. And, most of the time that's not really true.
Yeah. I wonder if we could go back to your idea from 2009 and really push for a commission on this so that people just keep being subpoenaed and stories just keep being told. I know there are already people saying, well, I was tortured by the CIA and nobody came and interviewed me for this damn report and that kind of thing. I wonder maybe if that would be a good approach to take at this point. It's not like they're going to appoint a special prosecutor, but maybe at the end of a commission they might have to.
No, I think that's exactly right. This same issue is played out in many other countries, especially in our hemisphere, down in Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, where intelligence services tortured at some point during their civil war and their guerrilla war, there were sort of sham investigations that produced nothing. And then what you had was over a period of 20 years exposure of the truth of everything that happened. And the public woke up to it, and then there were demands for accountability, including prosecutions. And that's resulted in the last 5 years in octogenarian military leaders and political leaders being tried, convicted, and sent to prison.
Yeah.
35 years after the fact. And I think, you know, in the United States, it's entirely conceivable we could see something like that happen here too. It's not going to happen anytime soon, but, you know, it might well happen over a period of a couple of decades. Yes. And I think that is what, you know, Michael Hayden and Hayden and several of the others are worried about. I mean, they're worried over this lengthy process. In fact, that even shows up inside this report. I mean, they had some one amazing thing is how the CIA manipulates the media and why. Mm. They've got just a fascinating passage here about how the CIA constantly leaked all, you know, highly classified information about these programs to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and broadcast media. All this was done as part of a coordinated campaign to make people think positively of the program, to give them a sense that it was effective, that it worked very, very well. And this was done, as they say, and they quote one of the deputy directors, "We either get out and sell or we get hammered." Because this has implications beyond the media. Congress reads the papers, cuts our authorities, messes up our budget. Right. Either we put out our story or we get eaten. There's no middle ground.
Now, let me ask you this. Aside from the CIA lawyers and commanders and officers and everybody who carried it out and all of the guilty there, when we go higher up the chain from there to the White House and the cabinet secretaries and that kind of thing, there really is, after Hirsch's book and Philip Sands and all these other books have been published on the subject, Jane Mayer, of course, there's really no question about who all the guilty are, all the principals and their lawyers. And I guess now there's a little bit of a question about what Powell knew when, that kind of thing. But otherwise, we know Tenet is guilty already beyond a shadow of a doubt. He's bragged about it. He's admitted it. Dick Cheney is guilty. George Bush is guilty. There's not a question that they are felons. They have broken the law, the torture statutes. Correct?
Well, I again, there's absolutely no question this went all the way to the White House and was approved in the White House. That's set out here clearly. A very interesting footnote showing up about Colin Powell. Because one thing we see here now, several passages where they're quoting CIA papers that acknowledge we lied to Colin Powell. We didn't share this information with him because if we did, and here's the quote, he'd blow his stack. Close quote.
You know, Marcy pointed out that ABC leak that he was in on it was probably a lie back then. She got that one. Remember that ABC story where they choreographed it? She said the purpose of that story was to try to implicate Powell. It probably wasn't true. Oh, man. See, I wanted to ask you so much more stuff, but now we got to go. But thank you so much for your time and all your great work on this important subject. We'll be speaking again soon.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. That's the heroic anti-torture lawyer, the other Scott Horton. Check him out at Harper's. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Okay, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org. Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. Next up is Phil Giraldi. He's a former CIA counterterrorism officer. He is the executive director of the Council for the National Interest at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. And he writes for the American Conservative Magazine and UNS.com. So welcome back. What do you know? What do you think of the torture report so far?
Well, I'm a little bit surprised, actually. It's much stronger than I thought it would be. I thought this collaborative process with the White House and the agency, redacting it and arguing over different points was something that basically was going to, denature the article in a sense, and study in a sense, and make it less effective. But there is some really strong stuff in this, and I would recommend your listeners, if they don't want to wait through the whole 525 pages, just read the first 10 or so. It's where they have the key findings and conclusions, and they run through a whole bunch of things. I think they're about 12 or something like that. Yeah, key findings and conclusions. And this stuff is dynamite. I mean, they talk about where the torture was far worse than it has been described. They use the word brutal. They talk about how the CIA basically sold a bill of goods in terms of the whole concept of the enhanced interrogations. And then after they sold the bill of goods, they pretty much lied about how effective it was and kept stuff from both Congress and from the White House. Considering that the White House was Bush and it was friendly, that's pretty astonishing.
Yeah, that was the other Scott Horton mentioned that a minute ago, how they didn't tell Bush. Do you believe that that's true? They didn't tell Bush that they were waterboarding anyone until 2006?
Well, that seems to be the conclusion. Now, bear in mind that this is this whole thing. The one thing that bothers me about this whole report is that it's document-driven. They didn't actually talk to anybody. And I would suspect that with my usual cynical spin on this, that if you're document driven, that means stuff that was deliberately concealed isn't here. So this could be the tip of the iceberg, and that it could be a lot worse than what we're seeing in this report. And the only way to get at these other things was if they had subpoenaed a bunch of the actual interrogators and questioned them under oath about what they did and what kind of orders they were receiving and so on and so forth. But, of course, they didn't do that. Mm-hmm.
And now let me ask you, what's exactly the proper term? A CIA officer, an agent, an asset, all these things are different. But to be a CIA officer, you have to be over 18, right?
You have to be a high school graduate.
Right, okay. So, I mean, we're talking minimal requirements here. I assume that there are other requirements beyond that. I don't know. Willingness to kill people on command or what. But
you have to differentiate. There are all kinds of CIAs. As you know, there's the analytical section of CIA. There's also an administrative section. There's a technical and scientific section. And that is what I was, which was a case officer. We were operations officers. But we operations officers were not the guys who did this kind of stuff. This stuff was done by a special activities branch, which was paramilitary. And these were the guys who got involved in Afghanistan with, running the operations on the ground with Al-Qaeda and subsequently running the operations in Afghanistan after the United States overran the country in late 2001. So this is a paramilitary group. Think of these guys as special forces. They are all ex-special forces or Navy SEALs. They have kind of a different perspective of the world. They're not exactly what I would call an intelligence officer. And these are the ones that basically carried out this kind of stuff, running the secret prisons and so on and so forth. So that's, yeah, and they're all over 18. I'm pretty sure of that.
Yeah. And so, in other words, they couldn't say, well, you know, they made me do it. Like Omar Khadr was mentioned on the show earlier because they were, I'm not sure if this is the specific reference. They might be talking about someone else in the piece, but they certainly threatened Omar Khadr that they would rape his mother. And then part of his story was, hey, man, I'm here with my dad and I'm a little kid and it's not my fault. And he ditched me with these guys and there was a firefight and I got kidnapped in it. I mean, what can I say?
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing. He didn't. He, whatever war crime he committed supposedly in attempting to defend himself from the Delta Force, he could reasonably argue that he was a little boy at the time and wasn't responsible, in fact, for what he did. And yet, but all of these CIA guys who carried out these acts, they are all, they don't have that excuse. They don't have any excuse to argue that what, they didn't know that torture was illegal, that they were breaking the law in violating their commander-in-chief's orders, that they didn't know that their oath is to the law and not to him, and that they don't have to, and that, in fact, they must not obey lawful orders?
Well, that's
unlawful
the
ones,
here.
I meant to say, obviously.
Yeah, so. Unlawful orders, sure. That's the whole point here. I mean, these guys essentially were participating in activities. The CIA is making two defenses on this, basically. On one hand, what they're saying is that this stuff worked, that they got actionable intelligence out of it that they otherwise would not have gotten. Now, that's a stupid argument because that's been disproven, and it was even disproven by the CIA's own inspector general. So that's a ridiculous argument, and this is the argument Jose Rodriguez keeps making. And the second argument was that it was legal. Now, the legality, of course, is based on a couple of memos that were issued out of the Justice Department, the Bush Justice Department, John Bybee and basically these guys said that anything short of organ failure was not torture. Well, that's kind of a high standard, or a low standard, depending on how you want to look at it. But the fact is, a guy who even believes that physically coercing a terrorist suspect is justified under the circumstances of post-9/11, if his brain is working at all, he realizes that taking a broom and shoving it up somebody's behind is something that goes a little bit beyond maybe pushing a guy around or even waterboarding him. And the fact is that this report documents that a lot of this stuff was commonplace. And as I say, since it's document-driven, I would suspect there was a hell of a lot more of this going on than what we're seeing from the documents.
Yeah. Well, I think we got to hope that this is just going to kick in the gate and allow all the rest of these stories to start rising up to the top. And there's been a couple of reports lately from people saying, well, no one talked to me. I was tortured by the CIA and no one talked to me. And I guess that's mm-hmm. why they mm-hmm. weren't really talking to anyone. But you're going to have more and more people saying, you know, answering the phone and answering reporters' questions as this, you know, picks up. And there's so much in here. I don't know how long of a news cycle. I'm hoping for a good week and a half or two out of this. Damn it. You know, maybe something, some kind of accountability for someone indict, Addington and you and then move from there. Get them squealing.
Yeah. Yeah. I absolutely agree. I mean, there are people that definitely should go to jail on this. And it starts right at the top. I mean, clearly if George Tenet was not being, forthcoming even with the White House, for God's sakes. I mean, these people, their heads should be rolling. I mean, Rodriguez, Cover Black, Jim Pavitt, you know, all these people that were involved in this program or acquiesced in it. And Rodriguez is, you know, now he appeared in the Washington Post on Sunday with another one of these idiotic op-eds, you know, claiming that it worked, it was legal, you know, we're all nice guys, we're wearing the white hats. But, you know, if he was condoning this, he knew exactly what was going on, he should be in jail.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other Scott was pointing out that this is such high-level illegality and so much of it, and like you're detailing, and in all kinds of different ways, too, that it, you can't help but notice the question is raised about the illegality of this entire institution. Who the hell do these people think they are?
Exactly. You know, exactly. It's like you said when you started out, you know, these are adults and they know that they're torturing somebody. There was no ambiguity about it.
Yeah. All right. Now, wait. I don't want the live audience to miss anything. We'll be right back, everybody, with more Phil Giraldi in just a sec. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Yeah, it's anti-war radio. Oh, I'm so used to saying that still. It's the Scott Horton Show. Same old show. Got Phil Giraldi on the line. We're talking about the CIA torturers and how they all belong in prison, and the boss is what sent them to. And so that was where we left off, was just the outright lawlessness. The revelation, I think, probably to a lot of people, Phil, of just what the national security state is as compared to the actual constitutional government of America that they learned about in civics class in high school, and just who these guys are and just who they think they are, which is apparently the masters of the universe beyond any law.
Yeah, that's clearly where their heads are. As when we were breaking there for the commercials, the thing I was saying was that there should have been, given what this Senate report is saying and what these guys actually did to these suspects, There should have been no ambiguity in their own minds or anybody's minds that this was legitimate kind of physical coercion up to a certain level to get people to talk. This went way beyond that. This is stuff that I haven't seen yet in the report. I would think that there's probably some stuff in here about people dying under these interrogation techniques. And if they're not in the report, it's probably because the documents were shredded. This is just incredible stuff. It's stuff you and I, growing up in this country, we would never have believed any of this could have possibly ever happened.
Well, now, so you were still at the CIA at the beginning of this. You say it was a different division, but did you guys you other CIA spies must have known that, like, hey, they're torturing the hell out of people, right?
No, we wouldn't have known. This kind of CIA, first of all, operates like most intelligence agencies on a compartmented basis. That means if you don't have a direct need for information for some reason, you don't see it, you don't get it. And this obviously, you remember when the Brennan when Brennan was up to get approved by Congress, some questions were arose about his involvement in the program, and he was at a very senior level, a very senior executive level, and it was clear that he kind of knew about the program, but he claimed that he really wasn't an enabler or an implementer of it. So the point is, even at that kind of level, he may not have had a lot of the details, but there certainly were people that had the details, and Rodriguez, who was chief of counterterrorism center at that time, in his recent op-ed and his book, is essentially saying that, you know, he ran the program. He was the one that ordered the videos destroyed. Now, if he had the videos, we would probably have more evidence of outrageous behavior of things being done. But that's why the videos were destroyed. The Rodriguez claims he did it to protect the interrogators from being identified. But that's a stupid argument, because, you know, I've seen interrogation videos and that sort of thing. They focus on the guy who's being interrogated. They don't show you the person asking the questions. So the whole concept is ridiculous. And essentially, these were destroyed because they were destroying evidence of war crimes.
Right. Well, now, so what about all of you former CIA officers who are anti-torture, that you guys go on a secret mission to get us the other 6,000 pages of this damn thing?
That's an interesting concept there, Scott, but if I could figure out how to do it, I certainly would do it.
Just break on in there and get it, man. I've seen movies. I know how you guys are.
I'd have to wrestle with Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah. Yeah, she might could stop you. I don't know. That's a pretty tough lady.
Sure. It would be great if we could see the whole thing. It would be great if we could just see the summary unredacted. Because the redactions are not as big as I thought they would be, but they still, you know, leave you wondering about some of the information that's been cut out. Mm. Sometimes it's very silly, like it talks about detention facilities in various countries, and they delete the names of the countries, whereas, of course, we know pretty much what the countries are. This has been in the public sector for quite some time.
Right. Yeah, I was pointing out earlier on the show, I like to, when this comes up, it was my wife, Larissa Alexandrovna, that reported when the Washington Post refused to, that reported the site of the torture facility in Poland, which belonged to Hitler and then Stalin and his, you know, followers, before it belonged to the CIA to be a torture facility there, which is a fun little footnote. And the president of Poland called her a liar. And of course, she's absolutely vindicated by every other report that never mentions her original one, but still names the same damn facility.
Yeah. So it's as they say, it's going to take a while, obviously, to read through this whole thing, and try to piece together some of the redactions and figure out what they're redacting. But the I think it's a damning report. I think it's I think this is worse than the Frank Church hearings, in terms of what it's managed to dig up. Cause back in the 70s, you know, in the 60s, people kind of expected some of this stuff, but now it's just, this kind of detail on a worldwide torture program run by the U.S. government is just absolutely astonishing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, they keep saying that telling the truth about the torture, releasing pictures of the torture, even the current force-feeding torture down at Guantanamo Bay, and the rest of this, that if you do this, you're going to engender terrorist attacks against us, as though it ain't the torture, it's the truth about it. But the truth about it is that Zawahiri was a friend of a friend of a guy who was in on the assassination of Anwar Sadat. He didn't do it, but they tortured him for it. But look out, because he's a surgeon. He's extremely intelligent, and now you made him mad. And the same thing with Zarqawi, only he was a two-bit rapist nobody, but in prison he was tortured in Jordan by America's sock puppet, King of Jordan, and decided that he was going to be a pure, lifelong holy warrior of jihad against Western interests and their sock puppets in the region after that. And he's the guy who did as much as Donald Rumsfeld to create the massive sectarian civil war that's tearing the entire Middle East apart right now. And that's where those guys, that's where those monsters come from, is the torture laboratory of America's sock puppet dictatorships in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm finding the whole pushback on this kind of ridiculous. They're arguing that, we're going to be vulnerable overseas, and the Obama administration is playing into this too, that we're going to be attacked because of the torture report. Well, that's ridiculous. That the United States has been torturing people has been known to everybody for a long time, and it's certainly been known to these people who are in terrorist groups. You think they need more motivation? I don't quite understand that. And the other argument being made is that this is going to hurt our relationships with other intelligence services because it reveals details and stuff. Well, that's a lot of bull too, because intelligence agencies don't share information and help each other because they love each other or they're close bosom buddies. It's because it is in their interest to do it. And every time there's been sort of a revelation in the past where it said, oh, this is going to hurt our intelligence relationships, it just has not been the case, because these organizations work together because they need to do that. And all these arguments are specious. They're ridiculous. And it shows how desperate really these people are to come up with something that they think is credible.
Yeah. All right. Now, of course, I'm in 1,000% agreement with you about just how huge this is, the way you compared it to the church committee and all of that. But we have to make it huge, because we still live in a world of Fox News that the 70s didn't have to quite deal with. And they got some heavy spin, and they're relentless, and they're going to keep spinning. So I wonder whether you would consider creating a group, something like VIPS, along those lines, probably many of the same members or something, but call it CIA Veterans for Prosecutions, and where you're specifically calling for accountability. Because, you know, just like with anything, everybody comes up with hashtag something irrelevant. The question is anyone going to be held accountable or not? And if you have especially conservative former CIA officers saying the rule of law is the rule of law, put them in prison, then that makes news, you know?
Well, I think that's a good idea. I certainly know a bunch of former CIA officers who feel about this just the way I do. It might not be a bad idea to try to pull something together. We are not about, obviously, as you know, we're not about to get invited onto Fox News to give our viewpoints. I don't think even MSNBC would be likely to have us on. But the fact is that, let's try to get something out there.
Yeah, you know, the MSNBC types might, if they have a big opportunity in a short time frame, kind of a thing to do it, a good press release, you know, put the most famous one of y'all's name at the very top or whatever it is, and it'd be worth a shot, man, I think, you know, I don't know. It's better than pirate radio hosts call for prosecutions. We're out of time. Thanks, Phil. We got to go. Appreciate it again.
Okay, Scott. Great. Bye-bye.
That's Phil Giraldi, everybody, the American Conservative Magazine. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.